Please turn back to 1 Kings chapter 5, 1 Kings chapter 5, as we continue this study on the life of this man, Solomon. Now, we noted last week how Solomon was blessed by great riches, great talents. He was given peace, he was given prosperity, he was given a nation and an empire by the Lord through the hands of his father. And one of the last things that his father charged him with was to build a temple for the Lord. That was the instruction David gave, and gave very specific instructions to Solomon. Now, David wanted to do that himself. We know the story as we have looked at the life of David. But God said to David, no, you're not to do it. Your son Solomon, who was not yet born at that time when God gave the instruction, but God said to him, you're going to have a son called Solomon, and this boy will be king in your place, and this son will build me a temple. Now, David could have taken a spiritual huff over that, couldn't he? He could have said, well, that's well, let Solomon handle it. I'll just keep out of it. Nothing to do with me. I wanted to do it and God turned me down. I'm giving up on anything to do with this temple. And of course, that's a great test for all of us, isn't it? When God says no, how do you respond? When God says no to a relationship, how do you respond? When God says no to a particular job that you desire, a particular ministry that you may covet or desire, in a good sense, and God says, no, that's not for you, do you take the spiritual huff with God? Or do you be like David and say, well, Lord, you're in control. It's your world. It's your church. It's you're the creator of my life. You're sovereign in all of these things. If you say no, that's enough for me. And I'm happy to do what I can to help the next man coming along to do the ministry that you want him to do. Turn with me to 1 Chronicles 22, because you get a little insight, very interesting insight, to the heart of King David when God tells him no. 1 Chronicles 22, it's not far from 1 Kings 4, just go a few books across in your Bible. 1 Chronicles 22 and verse 14. David is speaking here after God turned him down. He said, you're not to do this ministry for me. You're not to build this house for me. It's not going to be your honor, your privilege, David. What does David do? David says to, in verse 14, now behold, in my trouble, or in my poverty, is another way of saying that, I have prepared for the house of the Lord 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000 talents of silver, and of brass and iron without weight, for it is in abundance timber also, and stone have I prepared, that thou mayest add thereto. David didn't take a huff when God said no. David was said, well, if I can do anything to be a blessing to Solomon and to make this an even better house for the Lord when God eventually allows it to be built, I'm going to do it. Now, those figures that you read in 1 Chronicles chapter 22 may not seem very much to you on the surface. But let me just translate them into modern English and modern cents and dollars. David prepared roughly 3,750 tons of gold. 3,750 tons of gold. He prepared 37,500 tons of silver. Now, I just checked yesterday, I'm not sure how accurate the websites I checked, but this is roughly the price of gold and the price of silver today. That amount of gold is worth $64.3 million, 1 ton of gold. David prepared 3,750 tons of gold. That's equivalent, wait for it, to $241 billion worth of gold. $241 billion of gold. Silver, taking the silver price today, equates to around $37.5 billion worth of silver. Now remember, in that verse it says he not only prepared the gold and the silver, but he prepared the brass and the precious stones and the jewels and everything else. But let's just take the gold and silver together. Almost $300 billion worth of gold and silver. That's some sacrifice, isn't it? That's some effort by a man who has been told no by God. That's been told by God, it won't be you, it won't even be in your lifetime. You won't get any benefit from this, David. You won't even live to see this temple erected, David. Your son will have the privilege of building it, David. And yet David's heart says, if I can't do it, let me be a blessing to those who will do it. And David gathered of his own personal wealth around $300 billion worth of gold and silver. And he set that aside and he said to Solomon, now that's for the Lord. That's to build the temple of the Lord. Not many believers, let me say this, and it's very sad to say, would give an ounce of their time or money to something that didn't directly benefit them, themselves, or their families. And yet David here shows us the example when he says, it's not about David. It's about God, God's glory, and God's work. And I'm willing, he says, to sacrifice of the great wealth that he clearly had to make sure that God had the best temple for his glory. Now that's a good way to approach 2015. Ask yourself this question. Would you be willing to sacrifice for the Lord's glory in something that didn't benefit you directly? I believe that's a real test of the heart. It was a real test of David's heart. And David passed that test with flying colors. And you know, we always talk about Solomon's temple, don't we? You ever hear people talk like that? The temple that Solomon built. But actually, the one who laid the foundation, the one who instructed, the one whose idea it was in the first instance, was who? David. It really should be called, of anyone's name, David's temple. But yet David was willing to let others have that privilege, and willing to do what he could in order to be a blessing in this. Now this chapter, 1 Kings chapter 5, now I say all of that because you need to know all that information to understand what's going on now. 1 Kings chapter 5 is how Solomon begins to follow the command that his father gave him to build the temple. Now David didn't just tell him, we've just seen there, David put his money where his mouth is, and David set aside billions of dollars worth of gold and silver and iron and brass and wood and precious things in order to do it. So Solomon began with a great start here. But of course he still had to do it. Now how does it begin? Verse 1, we're introduced to a man called Hiram, king of Tyre. The kingdom of Tyre was a very wealthy kingdom and a very famous kingdom in ancient times. And really today it's where the country of Lebanon is and the northeastern corner of the land of Israel is today. It's that area where the kingdom of Tyre was. And this man Hiram was a Gentile. He wasn't a Jew. And yet we're told something about Hiram. Hiram, we're told, sent servants. These were really ambassadors unto Solomon. when he heard that Solomon had become king. Now, why did he do it? Did he do it because he was trying to ingratiate himself with the new king? Or because he heard Solomon was a very intelligent man or a very wealthy man and he'd be a good man to do business with, or a good man to have on your side with his great army and great hordes of horses and chariots that Solomon had accrued? No, we're told the reason why Hiram sent these ambassadors to Solomon at the end of verse 1. We're told, "For Hiram was ever a lover of David." This man, Hiram, loved the personality, loved the character of the godly father of Solomon. Now, if you were to go back through 2 Samuel, you would discover that Hiram was the man who built the house that David lived in, the David's royal palace, in 2 Samuel chapter 5. He sent cedar trees and carpenters to build David a wonderful palace. So there was a past relationship there. There was a past situation there. But here's what I want to point out, and it's very, very simple. Have you noticed in the Bible how men and women of God, others are attracted to them? They're likable people. They're people that inspire friendship, loyalty. They're people that inspire love between them and others. Just take King David. He was a man that right from his early days that we met him, was a man that other people were attracted to in a good way because of his integrity and his character. Even King Saul initially was a great admirer, someone who greatly respected David. It was only because of jealousy and malice in his heart that he turned against David. It wasn't because David did anything. Saul's daughter Michal loved David despite her father's warnings. Jonathan, the son of Saul, loved David and signed a covenant with David. We discover that when David was thrown out of Saul's palace, that hundreds of men made their way to what? Associate with David, to be led by David. They loved him, they admired him. And even when David said, "You know, I'd love to have a drink of the water of Bethlehem," three of his men went all the way to Bethlehem just to get a cup of water because of the love and respect they had for this man, David. And you see this right throughout David's life. Read the life of Joseph. Read how people admired Joseph. Read how his integrity was respected. It didn't matter whether he was in Potiphar's house. Potiphar admired him, promoted him. When he was in the jail for 2 years, the jailer admired him. And the jailer gave him the keys of the jail. So much was the respect he had for this man, Joseph. And when he came up before Pharaoh, Pharaoh admired him so much that he said, "You become prime minister." And not only became prime minister, he stayed prime minister. Now, that was another achievement. Read the life of Daniel, how in Daniel chapter 1, the chief of the eunuchs had great respect for Daniel, admired him, loved him. Read how all the kings of the Persians and the Babylonians, how they respected this man Daniel. And here's my point. Here's my point. Christians are meant to be people that others respect and like. Now, I know the devil can stir up individuals to oppose you. We can do nothing about that. Even Daniel had those who opposed him. David had those who opposed him. And Joseph had women like Potiphar's wife who tried to ensnare him. The devil has his people, that's true. But in a general sense, Christians should be likable people. They should have the grace of Christ in their lives and in their conversation. They shouldn't be people that other people want to keep away from. People that A.W. Tozer described as having diseased personalities. I thought that was a good description. Have you ever met someone like that? Supposed to be a Christian. And yet everybody in the office, everybody in the school, everybody in the workplace wants to keep away from that person. Because they're a person who frankly speaking, is not a very likable person. Well, that shouldn't be a Christian. Christians should always be someone that others are attracted to. Even if they don't like what we stand for, they at least respect it. Respect it. David was a man like that. Now, when you get to verse 7, you'll discover something about this man Hiram. And I'll link it for you in the scripture in a second. Because we're told when Solomon speaks to Hiram, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, I just want you to see this. He says, "Blessed be the Lord." Now you see the words "Lord" there in capitals. That's Jehovah in the Hebrew. "Blessed be Jehovah," says Hiram. Now this is a Gentile pagan king from a nation that produced pagan kings, because Jezebel was from Tyre and Sidon. Now here's this man Hiram, and he says, when he hears the news, he rejoiced greatly and said, "Blessed be the Lord this day, which hath given unto David a wise son over this great people." Now where did Hiram learn about Jehovah? How did he know that Jehovah has the power to raise up a son to succeed David? Why does he rejoice greatly in the knowledge that Jehovah, the true God of Israel, is at work in the land of Israel? I tell you where he knew. I tell you how he knew all about Jehovah. It was because David told him. David took the opportunity to witness to Hiram. That's why Hiram loved David. That's why Hiram could speak of Jehovah in such terms. Because clearly David had a testimony and an influence and wasn't afraid to testify of Jehovah to him. You know, sometimes when we move in higher circles, maybe with people who are senior to us, whether it's in the workplace or in society, we tend to try and hide the light under the bushel and think, well, you know, that person really doesn't need to hear about my faith, my beliefs. Well, you read the life of Daniel and you discover that every king that Daniel went before, whether it was Belshazzar, whether it was Nebuchadnezzar, whether it was Darius, Daniel told them about Jehovah. And according to the Jews, Daniel also told Alexander the Great that he one day would become the king of the Greeks. He prophesied that. But I'll give you a second piece of evidence why David must have testified to Hiram. If you go to 1 Chronicles 22 again. 1 Chronicles 22. Verse 4, we're told in verse 3 that David prepared nail, iron in abundance for the nails of the doors of the gates and for the joinings, and brass in abundance and without weight. And then it says this, also cedar trees in abundance, for the Zidonians brought much cedar wood to David. David had already spoken to Hiram. You'll discover this, not just here, but in other passages. And told Hiram that he's going to build the temple, or at least Solomon's going to build the temple. And he had already made preparation for that temple through Hiram. So when Solomon is going to speak this day in 1 Kings chapter 5 to Hiram about the temple, it's not new information. Hiram is aware of what's going on in the heart of David. David is a man who clearly has spoken of his love for the Lord and his desire to glorify the Lord in building this great temple. And he's even asked Hiram to help, and obviously done deals with Hiram to get the wood from Tyre and Sidon and from the forests of Lebanon in order to build the temple or prepare to build the temple. Now, of course, just in passing, I must contrast Solomon with David here. I said last week, one of the saddest, most tragic things about the life of Solomon was that all these people came from all around the world to learn of the wisdom of Solomon. And yet, by and large, Solomon failed to be a good testimony of the Lord to all these pagan Gentiles. What an opportunity. He could have been the greatest evangelist to the Gentile world, but he failed. But look how his father, by contrast, was a witness to the Gentiles. Look how his father David took the opportunity to reach out to men like Hiram, to establish the bonds of friendship, to tell Hiram about Jehovah and the work of Jehovah. Now, what's Hiram doing here in chapter 5? Let's go a little bit further here. Hiram, by sending his ambassadors here in verse 1, is testing the heart of Solomon. You see, Hiram knows the heart of David. He and David had a long-standing relationship. He knows that David is a man who has integrity, that David's a man whose word is his bond, that David's a man that you can trust. But he doesn't know very much about this young man, Solomon. And of course, he knows that in human character, people can change when they get power, when they get money, when they get influence. And Hiram is doing a very sensible thing here. He's testing Solomon out with these ambassadors. He's reaching out the hand of friendship, and he's trying to read what way Solomon's going to go. Notice how Solomon reacts. Solomon says in verse 2, he sends a message back, a very wonderful message in response to this man, Hiram. And he begins by reassuring him in verse 3 that he is just like his father. Notice how he does it. He reminds Hiram of who his father was and what his father had said, and how he is not intending to change the commands and instructions of his father. He's basically saying in verse 3, I am like my dad. What you saw in my father, you see in me. And he says, thou knowest how that David my father could not build an house unto the name of the Lord his God. How did Hiram know? Because David clearly had told him. Witness to him. And he says, for the wars were about him on every side until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. But now, the Lord my God hath given me rest on every side, so that there is neither adversary nor evil occurrent, nor evil opponent or occurrence. Behold, I purpose to build an house unto the name of the Lord my God. As the Lord spake unto David my father, saying, thy son, whom I will set upon thy throne, in thy room he shall build an house unto my name. So before Solomon enters into any business agreement with Hiram, he makes it very clear in these verses, in his introduction of his reply, I am walking in the footsteps of my father. You see, there's always a tendency and a temptation for a person succeeding another person to change things just to change, for the sake of trying to be different. There's always a temptation to try and prove yourself as somehow wiser or greater than those who have been before you. And that's never a wise thing for, especially a Christian, to do. We are to walk in the footsteps of those who have gone before. I'm not here to preach something new today. I'm here to preach the old gospel from the old book. We sing the old hymns of the faith because those hymns reflect what our forefathers believed and handed down to us down through the centuries. We don't need a new theology. We don't need a new way of worship. We don't need a new form of practice in any area of our ministries. No, we need to simply hold on to the past and pass it on down to the next generation. Now, let me just show you how biblical this is, because you may be sitting there thinking, are you sure? Are you sure that's right? If you go to 2 Timothy, 2 Timothy chapter 2, the Apostle Paul is writing his last words before he is martyred in Rome. And he's writing to a man who is his protege, Timothy. A man that Paul had led to Christ and Paul had ordained to be a pastor. And in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, here's what Paul says to this man Timothy. He says, "The things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses." So Paul links his practices, his doctrine, his teaching that Timothy had seen in his life, that Timothy had heard from the lips of Paul. Paul says, all those things that you've heard of me in the past, that I have handed on to you, Timothy. He says, the same, not different, commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. Paul picks four generations here. He says, I passed it to you, Timothy. Timothy, you pass it to others so that those others can then pass it on to others. Four generations. And Solomon very wisely has identified the good things in his father's life and his father's ministry and his father's teaching. And he's letting Hiram know, this is the faith of my father. This is how God led him and instructed him and guided him for not just his life, but for subsequent generations. And what I'm going to do today, Hiram, is I'm going to live up to that calling. I'm going to pass the baton on to another generation. That's what Solomon's saying. That's what he's reassuring Hiram that day. But then in verse 4, he's also letting Hiram know that he's not just simply following in his father's footsteps out of nostalgia. He's letting Hiram know in verse 4 that Solomon believes in the same God, and he believes in the same power of the same God, because he says, this God, the Lord my God, he's not just my father's God, he's my God. What kind of God is this? Hath given me rest on every side. What's Solomon trying to say there? Well, notice what he's not trying to say. He could have said this. He could have said, now you know I'm a very talented leader, Hiram. That I have the most amazing mind that any human has ever had on this earth to that moment in time. He could have said, now Hiram, you know how great an army I have under me, and how everybody's afraid of me, and because of that I have great peace and prosperity in my nation. No, but he doesn't. Solomon just simply points out to Hiram, the only reason there is peace and prosperity and success in my life, he says, because the Lord gave it to me. The Lord gave it to me. Now he's letting Hiram know as well, I'm not just walking nostalgically in my father's footsteps. I'm not just doing some task he asked me to do in a formal way. I'm doing it because I believe in the same God, and the same God's keeping me that kept my father. Verse 5. He says, and behold, I purpose. So he's now saying, he's rising up and saying, I'm going to do this. God has spoken through my father to do this, and I intend to do it, Hiram. Intend to do it. And I intend, he says, to build an house unto the name of the Lord my God. Now, he's very careful with the language he uses here, Solomon. He could have said, I'm going to build a house for the Lord. We tend to say that when we're speaking of Solomon's temple. He built it, a house for the Lord. But Solomon knows something about the pagans. He knows that they regard their gods as local gods, gods that can be confined in buildings or locations. And Solomon's just making clear to Hiram, the God that I worship, he's not restricted to a building. Therefore, this building is not there to contain God, it's there for God's glory, for God's name. It's a very careful distinction Solomon makes here. Very wise distinction. And then he repeats what God had said to David and how he wants to live up to what God said about David. In fact, Here's a question for you. How many times does Solomon mention the name of God in that response to Hiram? Just read it. You'll discover at least five times in those four verses, Solomon brings the name of Jehovah into focus. It's a very God-centered reply. It reveals a lot about the thinking of Solomon at this time in his life. How he sees God involved in every area of his life. How he sees himself being put on the throne because of God and kept there because of God. Now, there are many things that Solomon could boast in. We read it there in the last chapter. Solomon was the wealthiest man who ever lived. That's a big achievement, isn't it? Every time we open our newspaper, we read this guy, Bill Gates, or this guy, the wealthiest man in the world. The wealthiest man in Asia. And everybody says, wow, impressive, isn't it? Well, Solomon was the wealthiest man, not just in the world of his generation. He was the wealthiest man who ever lived on this earth. And yet, when you read his reply to Hiram, there's not a hint of it. Not a hint of it. Not only was he the wealthiest man that ever lived, he was the wisest, most intelligent, most brilliant man who ever lived. And yet, when you read his reply to Hiram, there's not a hint of it. Not even a boast about it in any shape or form. Now, when kings communicated in those days, they tended to boast one to the other with grand titles of our so-and-so lordship, worshipful leader, blah, 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 blah. But when Solomon replies, everything in his reply speaks of the Lord. Now remember, he's not just simply writing to another Jew. He's writing to a pagan king, Hiram. He's writing to a man who's his senior in years, and yet he's not ashamed to keep saying to him, Jehovah, Jehovah, Jehovah has done everything for me, and I want to do this for him, and I want him to get all the glory. And then Solomon in verse 6 makes his request to Hiram. He says, now therefore, command thou that they hew me cedar trees out of Lebanon, and my servants shall be with thy servants, and unto thee will I give hire for thy servants according to all that thou shalt appoint. For thou knowest that there is not among us any that can skill to hew timber like unto the Sidonians. Now, the Sidonians, the Jews, were pretty much an agricultural people. The Sidonians were world famous at that time for their ability to cut down the cedar trees that populated that land and to carve them into the most beautiful sculptures. And Solomon is not defensive about this. He's not trying to cover up. He knows that they're better at it than his people. And he just acknowledges it. And he says, I need your help. But then notice he says, I will give hire to thee. Solomon doesn't try to take advantage of the generosity and the friendship or even the strength of Solomon's army to try and get something for nothing from this man, Hiram. Oh, there's a good lesson. There's a good lesson. The Bible has a principle running through it that a person is always worthy of the hire. Always worthy. If someone does you a good turn, you make sure you repay it. Make sure you repay it. Don't ever try to take advantage of another person. I was reading a website recently, and they were complaining how Singaporeans of all nations boast in how shrewd they are. They call it shrewd, or how cute, or how clever they are in getting an advantage over other nations or over other people. Well, let's call it what it is. It's a sin. It's a sin to take advantage over others. And if you find someone in a situation, don't try to take advantage of them if they're in a desperate situation. If they're having financial problems, don't you go in and say, well, I'll buy this from you at a half price. I'll try to squeeze you a little bit because I know you're having certain difficulties in your business. Don't do that. Let's call it what it is. That's stealing. That's stealing. It's sin. Pay what you should pay. Treat people with dignity and respect. Everybody. Everybody. Don't take advantage of a single person. That's Christianity. Let me put it in a very simple way. You just look at the life of the Lord Jesus Christ and show me one instance where Jesus Christ took advantage of one person. Just show me one instance. I was talking to a dentist just about a month ago, Christian dentist in Singapore. And she was telling me how even professing Christians try to take advantage of her. Very rich professing Christians. They send their maids down with either no money or almost no money and try to get her to treat them for free. She said to me how disgusted she was by such behavior, especially by Christians. And Solomon here shows that he is a man of integrity. He tells Hiram up front, you do this for me and I will compensate you. You're worthy of your hire. The laborer is worthy of his hire. I'll make sure that your men are dealt with honorably and treated fairly. I won't take advantage of you, Hiram. I'm a man of integrity. And my nation is run with integrity. And I say this to you. Don't ever take advantage of others. Because the moment you do, you dishonor your own testimony. And you dishonor the testimony of the God whose name you bear. But let's move on. Solomon shows by his willingness to bring others in to help him a very typical Jewish trait. The Jews have always been people who are not afraid to learn from others. They've always been a race that will try things. And later in the Bible class, I'm going to show you some videos later today of how even the Jews today in Israel are one of the most innovative people on the planet. In fact, you could put it this way, they are the most innovative people on the planet. David Ben-Gurion, when he was the first prime minister, really, of Israel, when they got their independence as a nation in 1948, typifies the spirit of the Jewish mind, like Solomon here. Always willing to get the best from wherever he can get it. Learn from the best. David Ben-Gurion came to the best group of scientists in Israel and he said to them, I want you, he says, to plant trees in the Negev desert in order to make it flourish again. Because Israel in 1948 had very limited borders and a very limited amount of natural land to farm and to harvest. Ben-Gurion asked his scientists, so-called best scientists in Israel, to go and find a way to do it. They came back and after a period of time and they came to the cabinet meeting with where Ben-Gurion was there with the rest of the cabinet and they said, Prime Minister, I'm sorry to say that we have looked at this and we just can't see a way that it can be done. It's impossible. Well, Ben-Gurion, his response was not, let's give up. You know what his response was? Let's change the scientists. Let's try something else. Let's try another group of people. See if they're any more innovative. And Ben-Gurion found another group of scientists. And today the Negev desert is flourishing and blooming because of the foresight and the tenacity and the innovation of men like David Ben-Gurion. And Solomon here just typifies it. He just says, well, if these Gentiles can do it better than the Jews, let the Gentiles do it. Bring them in, bring the best to do the work of God and build the greatest house for the Lord. Now, how does Hiram respond to that? Is he cynical? Is he suspicious? He says in verse 7, no. My heart greatly rejoices. I'm so happy. Remember, Hiram is the older man. He's the experienced man. It's not easy for this older king, who is David's contemporary, to rejoice in the amazing success of this prince, this young boy, Solomon, who has not just got the greatest mind, but he's inherited the most powerful empire in the world at that time. And yet Hiram is not jealous, he's not envious. He just responds and he says, well, thank God. Thank Jehovah that he has given unto God's people a wise man to lead Israel. Hiram not only makes this response, but in verse 8 you discover, in 9, he makes the commitment. He says, I'll do it. You ask me for these cedar trees, I'm going to give it to you, Solomon. I'm going to seek to be a blessing for you and for your people and for your God. Now, it's easy to make promises, but it's not always easy to live up to promises. And Hiram, he lives up to his promise. He really sends the timber from Lebanon or from Tyre down to the land of Israel. And Solomon, notice how he responds. You see, there are many people who will make promises, especially when it comes to money. But I can tell you, when it comes to money, they soon change their mind. And Solomon here, he not only makes the promise. Remember, he made the promise to Hiram, you bring your men, I'll repay them. As soon as the wood touched down in Israel, Solomon paid the debt. His word was his bond. His word was his bond. You know, I remember the first time when I came out of university, I went to work in a law firm. First seat in litigation. And I remember the very first case that came in, there was two men who were entrepreneurs. And they'd come up with a way to help this company, these two directors from another company, to market their product. And they struck an agreement that they would receive a certain amount of commission if that product was marketed by these two entrepreneurs. Now, these two men, by their own admission, didn't have to do very much to market this product. But in the space of 12 months, it went way beyond their expectations. And because it exceeded their expectations, the two directors of the company owed them a big check of commission. And guess what happened? When the time came to pay the bill, the love of money gripped the heart of these two directors. And they said, no, you haven't done enough. They said, but that's the deal. We struck the deal. Is there in writing? They said, but no. Let's change the terms. We'll offer you 20%. I can't remember how much. Something like that. A fraction of what they owed that person. And I tell you that illustration because it just is so typical of when the bill comes in to be paid, how the heart of man often revolts. And I say this to you as Christians. Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. I grew up in the United Kingdom. It used to be said, you know, that an Englishman's word is his bond. Now, I don't know how true that always was, but that was the expression. In the city of London, stocks were exchanged through oral contracts. They didn't write it down because the stockbrokers knew that their word was their bond. And if they incurred a debt, they would pay it. That was the integrity of the system. Now, of course, today they've had to shift to formal contracts. Why? Because no longer is the Englishman's word his bond. It can't be trusted. He may say something that day, but the next day he'll just change his mind when it suits. Well, Solomon here shows us that's not how a Christian should behave. Never. When you say something, you better do it. You better do it. Now, that doesn't just apply to money, although in this context it's talking about money. That applies to everything. It applies to everything. When you take a vow, whether it's in the marriage, whether it's in the church, whether it's in some other walk of life, when you say, I'm going to do something, you better do it. You better do it. Oh, I know the world will say, no big deal, let it go. It's only an aspiration. It's only romantic words. It's only idealistic words. Well, God says, you said it, I'm going to hold you to it. I'm going to hold you to it. And let your word be your bond in every area of your life. That's a Christian. Whether it's in the home, with your children or with your spouse, whether it's in the workplace, dealing with unsaved people or even other Christians in the business world, you better make sure your word is your bond. Whether it's in the church, you give a commitment, you better keep to it. Now, why is it so important that we keep to our word? Because God is truth. Remember, Jesus Christ said, I am the way, what? The truth and the life. Any attempt to dilute the truth is an attack on the person and character of God. And any time we as Christians tell a half-truth, that's what it's called, it's just a lie really, or we twist the truth, or we try to break our word, we are attacking not just the individual that we're sinning against, we're sinning directly against God. We're sinning against the character of God. Now, we expect God to keep his word to us, don't we? Oh, we get very upset, don't we, if God does. He said, Lord, you promised to do this and you haven't done it. Now, if we expect God to keep his word to us, surely we, as those who bear his name, are required to keep our word, our commitments. You know, God kept his word to Solomon. You see it in verse 12 here. It's even underlined for us in this chapter, because we're told, and the Lord gives Solomon wisdom as he promised him. As he promised him. That's God. When God says something, God does something. Not 99% of the time, 100% of the time. And we as Christians are required to do the same. And if you take an oath, you give a commitment, you sign a contract, God will hold you to every word you say. And don't sign it, don't say it, if you don't mean it. Don't say it. Because you're blaspheming God's name by even using God's name in such a context if you don't mean it. Now, Solomon lives up to it. He not only lives up to it, but verse 13 to verse 18, we discover that Solomon gathers a group of conscripts from the nation. Now, this may seem somewhat harsh in today's terms, 30,000 men. Let me put it in context. When David numbered the nation of Israel in the census, there were 1.3 million men in Israel, fighting men. This group that he takes out as conscripts to help build the temple of the Lord equates to just 2.3% of the male population of Israel at that time. So it's a very small number. And notice how Solomon handles them. He makes them work for 1 month, and then he allows them to be with their family and work at home on their own farms and their own area of business for 2 months. So it's a very fair and balanced approach he has to this conscription. He treats everybody with respect. Notice this. He treats Hiram with respect. He treats Hiram's workers, Hiram's servants with respect. And he treats the men of Israel with respect. There's a good lesson for all of us, isn't there? The dignity, the respect, the honor that Solomon shows to all those people. And do you know, according to the Jewish tradition, now this is not in the Bible, but this is according to the Jewish tradition, it took 7 years to build the temple. But according to the Jews, not one person fell sick of those workers in those 7 years. Not one person was injured in those 7 years. God blessed the way Solomon ordered this and prepared this and handled this. How he was wise. How he was humble. How he had integrity in his dealings with others. How his word was his bond. How when he made the commitment, he kept to the commitment. Let me say this. Solomon was acting just like his father David, wasn't he? In this chapter. Because that's how David operated. But let me raise this a little bit higher, because we can go higher than David. Solomon was acting just like the Lord when he handled this situation in this way. He was acting like the God who is a God that's lovable, a God that is love, a God that makes commitments and keeps his commitments. A God who treats people with respect and dignity. A God who made every human in this world in the image of God. Showered them with blessings. And you know, with this I close. Solomon did this preparation for the temple in a very honorable way, in a very orderly way, in a very godly way. And God blessed it. And God used it. But sad to say, you know, Solomon didn't always do this. Because later in life, because he reigned for 40 years, Solomon began to build great houses for his own multiple wives that he took. And he began to impose onerous taxation and onerous conscription rules on the men of Israel. And you know when that happened? When he backslid. One of the signs of backsliding is how you treat others. Remember the commandments that the Lord Jesus Christ said. What's the first great commandment? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might and all the rest of it. We know the ending. But he says the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And you see, when you get the first one wrong, when you walk out of fellowship with the Lord, you'll start to see your relationships break down with others. That's where you'll see it work itself out. And that's where Solomon lost out in his relationships with his fellow man in later lives, because he had lost out in his relationship with the Lord. That was the evidence of it, or one of the evidences of it. Let me ask you a question today. Because tomorrow morning, most of you are going to get on the train or the bus or get in the car and go into the workplace. What's your reputation there? Are you known as a schemer, a cynic, ruthless person, a person who takes advantage, a person who can squeeze every cent out of every dollar in order to take advantage of another person? Is that your reputation? A person whose word can change depending on the circumstances. A person who is known as a person not to be trusted. Whose word is not his or her bond. Is that you? Because if that's you, that's the most shameful thing. It's the most shameful thing. It's the most tragic thing. It's something that you need to change. You need to think about. I've mentioned the workplace. I could have mentioned the home, couldn't I? I could have mentioned the church. I could have mentioned all the other areas of life. And I just challenge you, leave you with that this afternoon. Solomon began well because he began by walking with God. He began by treating others properly. His word was his bond. He had order and dignity in the way he conducted himself. He tried to walk in the footsteps of his father. He acknowledged his creator in everything. That's how he began this great work for God. But at the end of his life, he didn't end that way. And I just simply say this, and with this, my last tip. That's a warning to us all that you can begin with the right motive, the right heart, and the right method. You can start out so well. You can rise up and say, I'm going to serve the Lord in this. I'm going to do this in the workplace, in the home, and in the church. And you can make all these commitments and promises, and you may mean them. And you may even live up to them at the beginning. But Solomon's life is a warning that that fervor, that integrity may not last. May not last. And I say this especially to those who are older here today. Are you still going on with the Lord? Can you say, hand on heart, I love Him more today than I did yesterday? That I want to walk with Him more today than I did yesterday? Can you say from the depths of your heart that I'm a more spiritual person as I end 2014 than I began 2014? Can you say that? Because if you can't, you're backsliding. You're on the path that Solomon got on, and he didn't get off it for 40 years. Think about those things. Think about them very carefully, prayerfully. As we end 2014 and go into 2015. Hear the word of the Lord today. Let us pray.